So the model we're going to start by studying is one of the simplest of these 2D integrable field theories. It's called the Thiering model. So first I'm just going to write down what this model is, and then I'll explain how to engineer it from the 4D theory in such a way we can see that it's integrable. So this has UN symmetry. And the fields are so there's N chiral fermions psi I, and this is in two dimensions. In the fundamental representation, also another n psi upper I, which are in the anti-fundamental representation, there's n anti-chiral fermions psi bar I in the fundamental of UN and N antichirals psi bar upper I in the anti-fundamental. So the action is the integral of R2. So first there's just the usual kinetic term. And maybe before I go on, I should apologize. You guys have kind of, physicists have kind of strange conventions for reality conditions of fermions. We're a Newtonian signature. In Newtonian signature, chiral fermions are necessarily complex. There's no way to make them real. So these are all complex, but if the complex conjugates, let me write this as a star instead of a bar, and also a tilde or something like that. Because I don't really want to think of these guys as the complex conjugates of these right now. Okay, so the action is the usual one. And then there's the unique UN invariant and scale invariant quartic interaction you can write down, some coupling constant. The unique marginal UN invariant interaction. Okay, any questions? I always worry, kind of different conventions between math and physics that confuse people at this point, but I hope it's reasonably clear. So these models were much studied in the 70s and 80s. Did you get onto these continuum field theories, Pedro, or you just talked about the discrete setting?
I spoke a little bit about Sine-Gorman, which is the dual of some of this, but I did not mention that.
Yes. Okay, so if you apply the boson-fermion correspondence, this quartic interaction becomes the Sine-Gorman model, at least when n is 1. But the interesting features about these is that...
And I discussed the O-N sigma model.
Great, okay. And you explained how they're, in what sense they're integrable, like the particle spectrum and...
Yeah,
I
mean,
okay.
Particle spectrum and the SNA effect.
Great. So Pedro then explained all the hard stuff that you can, you know, if this you can understand the S matrix explicitly. Well, the aspect of the story I want to discuss is not so much the S matrix, but the fact that these models have a Yangian symmetry. So what I want to explain is I want to engineer these models from the point of view of the four-dimensional gauge theory in such a way that the Yangian symmetry is manifest in just the same kind of way we saw how the RQT presentation of the Yangian appeared when we thought about spin chains. So in the four-dimensional gauge theory, we saw how to understand spin chains by inserting Wilson lines. So in any gauge theory, Wilson lines are the most basic observables you can insert. But we can insert more complicated things as well. Instead of inserting one-dimensional defects, we could also insert two-dimensional defects. So what we'll do is on or two times C, we'll insert 2D, they're called surface defects. At fixed points in the complex plane, or two times z zero, or two times z one. And well, for Wilson lines, the most familiar expression of how to insert a Wilson line into a theory would be to take the path-ordered exponential of your gauge field. This is a simple formula. But we explained, we saw in the tutorial yesterday, that you could get the same formula if instead of writing on the path-ordered exponential, you coupled a one-dimensional free fermion onto your Wilson line. One-dimensional free fermion system into your gauge theory. Now, if you try to go to insert higher dimensional operators, like a surface operator, the formulas involving the path-ordered exponential, they're not quite so nice anymore. But the expressions involving the insertion of a free fermion, you can always do that. So that's the way of looking at things, but generalizes very easily. So that's how we think of these surface defects. So at z0, we'll insert a chiral free fermion. So here we're going to take the gauge group to be, say, un, or we think of it as gln if you prefer. We'll insert a chiral free fermions. So in the fundamental plus the anti-fundamental representation, so what does that mean? We introduce some extra fields. Fields psi I of x, y, and psi upper I of x, y. These don't depend on z. They only live at a fixed value of z. They're extra degrees of freedom on this surface, which are coupled to the gauge theory with an action of the form let me write it out completely explicitly. Integral psi I a w bar say I j psi j. Okay, so all we've done, so we've done the following. Here w is x plus I y. What have we done? We've taken the usual interaction for a chiral free fermion. And in Euclidean signature, chiral fermion only propagates in one direction, which in Euclidean signature is the W bar direction. That's why it's chiral. And we've replaced that derivative by the covariant derivative. So we've introduced this term involving the gauge field. So it's just that the most obvious thing you can do this in any gauge theory. So similarly, at another point, say z1, we can introduce an anti-chiral free fermion. With the same kind of action. Where I introduce the covariant derivative, but now using W instead of W bar because it propagates in the other direction, because it's an anti-chiral fermion. And so the claim is that when we integrate out the gauge field, A, these models become coupled. And they give the theory model. Okay. So this is good. This is actually very analogous to the way we had two Wilson lines crossing. We integrate out the gauge field. They're coupled, but just at a point. And they give the OR matrix. The difference here is because these theories, they don't just live in a line. They live in a whole surface. They get coupled at every point. And the coupling is kind of similar to the OR matrix we will see. So I want to explain this firstly in a slightly naive way, and then in a more subtle way, in the more kind of more scientific way, which will kind of address the subtlety in the analysis. So a slightly naive way of doing it would be, let's write down the field sourced by this surface operator. Consider the field sourced by the surface operator at z0. So how do we figure out what that is? We think about the action. I'm only going to write down the quadratic term in the action, because that's all that would be relevant. So we'll need this term too, of course. Psi. So if we vary A, so there's an implicit dW here. dA, dz dA plus this delta function times psi psi so one solution to this equation if I take A, A, the ij entry of A the z bar component, the ij entry to be equal to minus 1 over 2 pi I 1 over z minus z0 times psi I psi j.
What happened to the other term in the transcendent section?
The cubic term?
That doesn't compute.
It doesn't contribute to this particular calculation because what we're computing is really the exchange of a single gluon between these two surfaces, and that does not involve the interaction. So it's some approximation to a more complicated thing which would involve interactions. But we just want the leading term. Okay. Let me get this right. This is a W component. So one way to solve the equation is this. Now we insert this into the other fermion. And we get the integral psi I, psi j, psi tilde j, with a factor of 1 over z minus z0. At front, up to some factors of 2 pi I. Okay, so the same kind of thing we did before. Before we took a Wilson line, looked at the field it sourced, and then saw what that did in the other Wilson line. We've taken a surface and looked at the field it sourced and saw what that did in the outer surface. So the reason this analysis is kind of naive, and it would be better to give a more refined analysis, is that I haven't mentioned the gauge. I've just talked about solving the equation, and I've written down one solution. But normally, you'd want to think about the solution being in the correct gauge. Another point is, so typically, if we had some gauge field and I integrated it out, I would get a non-local interaction between the surfaces because it could propagate in the x, y direction too. But that's not what we're finding. We have to justify that step. And what we'll find if we analyze things carefully is that with the correct choice of gauge, we can take this field A to be very, very massive. And therefore, integrating it out will give rise to a local interaction. So let's try and explain that, and we'll arrive at the same conclusion by the more careful analysis. Okay, any questions? Actually, maybe to explain a point that kind of briefly confused me is that the psi, maybe if we erase this, the psi, because they're chiral fermions, they transform like the square root of dw. So two psi's give a dw. So when I vary A, I find only the, you know, we're going to match up the w component with this guy, and that's why we find the w component is the one that's going to be giving that expression.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah?
Do you know if you try to just integrate out the fermions, could you give a description in terms of the gauge fields of like what the surface defect is?
Yes, this was question 6 on the. So So what you put the fermions in a torus. If we integrate out a, if you remember, this is really fun actually. So if we did it on a circle with a one-dimensional fermion, we integrated it out, you found an expression in terms of the zeta function. So the zeta function is the sum over 1 over n to the 2k. Now, if we do it on a torus, you find the same expression, but you find 1 over n plus n tau to the 2k, which is the Eisenstein series. So that there is an expression involving the exponential of the Eisenstein series applied to one of the, coupled to some trace of the gauge field. So it's some kind of.
But it doesn't have a sort of neat description the way it looks like that.
As a path ordered exponential?
Yeah,
well, the other description you would get would just be writing down the Feynman diagrams on a torus. If you think about Feynman diagrams on a circle, the propagator for the Feynman diagram is like a delta function that one is to the left of the other. With some work, you can turn that in, you can derive the path ordered exponential from that. Now, on a torus, there's an expression involving one loop Feynman diagrams, but just the propagator is different, so it's just not quite as. It's like the propagator is like 1 over z.
Analogous to the one you did yesterday for the surface defects, where you somehow can compute like the sort of OPE of the surface defects and see that you get some other surface defect of a similar form, maybe with some derivatives on the coupling with A or something like that.
Yeah, I think there should be. That's kind of what we're doing, right? We can think of these surface defects as coming close together, and then we're just the OPE, and in the limit, they get coupled by this quartic term. To get something closer to what we did yesterday, you would want to take chiral and anti-chiral is the analog of having two perpendicular lines. But chiral and chiral is the analog of having two parallel lines. So one could compute what happens when you take two chiral surface defects together, and do they couple in some way. Actually, I've never done that. But there should be something. Okay, so here's how to arrive at the same conclusion in a more reasonable way. So let's compactify the complex line C to the complex projective line CP1 by adding on a point at infinity. Let's extend all our fields to infinity by asking that they vanish at infinity. I said that they're near infinity. They're divisible by 1 over z. Which is a local coordinate at infinity. Then our action still makes sense. The integral or 2 times CP1 So this still makes sense because this field vanishes at infinity. So this one vanishes at infinity. dz has an order 2 pole at infinity. So but that order 2 pole cancels with the order 2 vanishing coming from these terms. So this expression makes sense, and similarly this expression makes sense. So if we compactify to or 2, What we're going to do is we're going to compactify this theory to OR2 and analyze the Kaluza-Klein spectrum. And if we include the surface defects, we find the following. Chiral plus anti-chiral fermions on R2. And secondly, you have to think about what does this gauge field become when we view it in a two-dimensional plane. So if I take my four-dimensional gauge field, AX, Y is a 2D gauge field. But it's a one-form valued in, we have to think about how does this one form depend on the extra dimension. So it has a bunch of components, which can be labeled by functions on CP1. O minus 1 is just a certain nine bundle on CP1, and it indicates that they vanish at infinity. Now, the z bar component, this will transform as a scalar in two dimensions. Which we'll call B. And what this, so it's a scalar in R2. But again, it has a bunch of components coming from how it depends on this two sphere. So to get a better feeling for this, maybe we can think about decomposing into the eigenvalues of the Laplacian on CP1. Well, there's an SU2 symmetry, so every eigenspace of the Laplacian will be some SU2 representation. And if you think about spherical harmonics, you'll find that the odd spin representations appear in the spectrum here and here exactly once. So we have AJ, J odd is a one form. Oh, sorry, not odd spin, half integer spin. And spin J, J representation of SU2 for J half integer. And similarly, BJ is a scalar in spin J representation.
The original action that we are dimensionally reducing still has the fermions, right?
Yes, it has the fermions. Sure. But they don't have any dependence on Z, so they don't have any collusive time modes.
Right.
So what we're finding in a two-dimensional point of view is the fermions plus a bunch of other fields
coming from A,
and we'll integrate those out.
Sure.
And see what we find. So let's see what the action looks like. I'll only write down the quadratic part of the action for A, just for simplicity. So upstairs we have the ADA action. So that all was involved one component in, which is in the XY. We have this right. Okay. So the integral of OR2. So there's components where I take this guy. Then I apply d bar in the p1 direction. To the other one. And I integrate this over two, OR2. Now this involves no derivatives in OR2, so this looks like a mass term. And there's another term. Which involves this looks like some kind of BF interaction.
So the SU2 comes from the fact that we're reducing on CP1, right?
That's right. So there's SU2
spherical harmonic. In addition to that, the A's and B's should have a group theory index from the original.
Yes, that's right. So I've been suppressing that additional group theory index. Okay. So we find this kind of mass term with this interaction. And I forgot to mention the gauge symmetry. So let's assume, you know, just for simplicity, we'll assume this is the case of U1. It's not really any different than the more general cases. Upstairs, for the case of U1, the gauge symmetry was I add on d of a scalar. So here it looks like the following. So all I've done is written down the gauge symmetry we had upstairs in this two-dimensional language. So here it's a usual gauge symmetry for a connection. But if you think about it, you know, why is this the only thing that can happen? If I just write down a mass term for a gauge field, that's not gauge invariant. So I have to have another term involving B to make it gauge invariant. And that's what this term does. OK, so Xj is a scalar on OR2 valued in the spin J representation. So far all we've done is something you would, yeah. This is an analysis of what you can perform for any field theory. You compactify it on a nice manifold, like a two-sphere. You analyze the spectrum, and you write down what the action looks like. However, here there's something nice happens. The Dalbo cohomology of which looks like this. The cohomology of this complex, this is just zero. Sorry, I forgot to include the important feature that this is valued in O minus one. The fact that this piece is zero is obvious. There is no functions. There's no holomorphic functions which vanish at infinity. That's clear. This piece vanishes by surduality. Serduality? The point is, like, this is like a square root of dz. So this is a, this looks like square root of dz dz bar. So I can integrate something here against something here. So they're dual vector spaces. So that harmonic stuff in them is dual vector spaces. OK. So once we know this, think about what does it tell us? It tells us some very nice things. Firstly, these masses, this matrix of masses, is entirely non-degenerate. Because this operator, this del bar operator, is an isomorphism. So this pairing is non-degenerate. And secondly, because del bar is an isomorphism, it says that every gauge field, every B, is gauge equivalent to zero. I can add on something like that. So we can do the following. We can choose a gauge. The partial gauge fix. Where is it a partial gauge fix? No, it's a complete gauge fix. Where bj is equal to zero. This fixes it uniquely. Now, if we do this and go back to our interaction, we gauge fix so the b's vanish, then this term just goes away. And we're just left with this mass term. So we find the field A does not propagate, but is massive. So that means that we can integrate it out and generate a local interaction. So with b equals zero, the action becomes a j d bar a j. So this guy, as I said, is not propagating from the two-dimensional point of view. And there's a non-zero mass. OK, so then, well, what would we do then? We just, you know, anytime I, for example, if I had a field phi with the interaction just phi squared, no mass, with no propagation, then what I get when I integrate out that field is a delta function. The delta function is proportional to the inverse of this matrix of masses. So given, so if we introduce the other fields again, psi tilde again, we're going to have an interaction which looks like this. Or two. And integral psi of A. So integrating out A will because it does not propagate. Gives a local interaction. And because the inverse of the dbar operator on CP1 is 1 over z, we get exactly the expression we found before. Okay, sorry, I hope this wasn't too fast. Okay, I hope this was a reasonable thing to do. I mean, I wanted to explain this point because I felt like I was lying to you guys a little bit about some subtleties in our earlier discussion. Yeah?
So the fact that we are imposing a certain boundary condition on A, and which is making the C to CP1,
mm-hmm.
that does that exclude any possible gauge transformations?
Oh, we must, excellent point. Yes, we also look at the gauge transformations which vanish at infinity. Yeah, otherwise, that's implicitly I'm doing that here by saying this field X is a function which vanishes at infinity, which is, so that this cohomology vanishes. Yeah. So it's I mean as a general kind of philosophical remark, you can ask, you know, what other Riemann surfaces can I play this game on? So what you need is a Riemann surface with a one form, which doesn't vanish anywhere, and some boundary conditions, infinity, such that there are no zero modes, just like we have here. So there are only three possibilities. CP1 with a one form dz and vanishing and this condition at infinity. CP1 with a one form dz mod z and a condition at zero and infinity, or the elliptic curve with a particular SLN bundle. And these three possibilities reproduce the three classes of known integrable models. So one last point to make about this stuff, with this choice of gauge and how it leads us to a local interaction, we might ask, I chose this funny gauge where I just got rid of the field B. So what's the meaning of that? Four dimensions. In four dimensions, on OR2 times CP1, well, the metric on CP1 does not play a role in the action. However, it does play a role in the gauge fix. Because we might ask that, d star of A x, y plus d bar star of A z bar equals 0. This kind of condition, which we wrote down before, this involves, you know, the x derivative of ax, the y derivative of ay, and the z derivative of az bar. So that there's an implicit choice of metric on CP1 and saying, you know, what the z derivative with what factor. So the gauge that leads to a local interaction is when the volume of CP1 tends to 0, which is a reasonable thing. Like when I choose my gauge fixing condition so that this becomes very small metrically, then things propagate much more in the z direction than they do in the xy direction. And in the limit, when it tends to 0, they don't propagate at all in the xy direction and only in the z direction. Okay, so maybe I think I'd like to spend maybe 5 minutes talking about how this kind of picture allows one to understand integrability in these 2D theories, and we'll come back to that again tomorrow. So what we're going to do is just draw the same picture as we did before. So we'll draw the same pictures we did before, except we'll have surface operators as well as line operators. So the first thing to explain might be, you want these theories to be integrable, you might want to produce some number of conserved currents. So consider the 4D theory on or times S1 times C as before, with surface operators at z0 and z1. Now, if we put a Wilson line which wraps the circle at some point z, which is near infinity, draw the picture. So maybe I have one surface operator there, one surface operator at z1, and at some other point, z, I'll put a Wilson line. Now, when we integrate out these gauge fields, in the way we've discussed, and the Wilson line gives, by exchange of gluons from here to here, it gives a line defect in the two-dimensional theory. Which in our case is the theory model. So this line defect, because we're on a circle, it will give us an operator. It gives us some operator on the Hilbert space. Well, now, I can move this Wilson line up and down, and I won't change anything. My topological symmetry is a theory. If you think about in the 2D theory, the effect of 2D theory, that means you're having a line defect that can move up and down. That just means it's conserved. It commutes with the Hamiltonian. So since we can move the Wilson line around, this is a conserved operator. Okay, just the Hamiltonian has to do with time translation. So I get the same thing if it's here, if it's here. So it must commute with the Hamiltonian. Further, T of z and T of z prime is equal to 0. Therefore, we get, by expanding in series in T, we get an infinite number of conserved operators. Okay, so this is kind of a formal picture of why, just from the fact that the theorem model arose from integrating out the gauge fields, it must be integrable. So next time I want to discuss how to realize a few other models and also why these models have Yangian symmetry. Okay, so.